go over a few of the sort of loose ends that have been left from the last 2 days of hearings, go over our policy option packages, give you an opportunity to talk with folks from the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, and we're expecting some of our county partners to come in and testify towards the end of the morning. We at your place, there should be a little packet titled Joint Ways and Means General Government Subcommittee Response to Subcommittee Questions. We tried to capture the questions you asked on Tuesday and yesterday, for which we didn't have ready answers, and provide that information. And so we've set forth the questions and the responses, and there are a couple of attachments that go with those where it's needed. My plan was not to review each of these questions, but to commend them to you, and then if on Monday there are any additional questions or inquiries that we can respond to, we'd be happy to do that. I guess the one I'd point out would be on the key performance measures. That's the last question on pages 4 and 5. There was a question about the timing of the information that went into those measures. And so what we've tried to do is tell you what the latest data is, if we've got more recent data, or if the data is time constrained, what the source is and why it's time constrained.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Mr. Archenko, on the answer to your question one, you said you cannot estimate the size of the underground economy because there is no reporting mechanism for compiling the data. I would ask another question. How would you create a reporting mechanism for compiling that data?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, when I think of the underground economy, I think of criminal activity. And I think of activity where people are deliberately using either barter or cash transactions to avoid being counted in the record-keeping system. So I can't imagine a way to collect information about that sector of our total economy. If people are deliberately structuring their activities in a way that they are avoiding participating in the parts of our activities where we keep records, I don't know how we would, unless we had an army to go out and monitor what's going on in the world and looking over people's shoulders. It's a cash-based economy that we don't have anywhere close to the resources to begin to try to monitor.
Follow up, I assume.
Yeah, it would seem to me that there should be certain percentages that your auditor should be able to look at, or you could even might create software programs to look at, whereas you have a certain, as a contractor, a builder, a residential builder, you would have a certain percentage of income that you would expect would be written off as labor costs. And if those labor costs were outside of a certain framework, it would seem that would trigger a mechanism to look and see are you just super efficient, or are you paying someone a different way? I don't think it would be that difficult to create parameters where you could look at something and suggest, it wouldn't necessarily identify a particular taxpayer as being out of compliance. It would just say he's out of the norm, and maybe you should pull that return and look at it. And that's just one example, but I mean, there's any number of ways that people avoid paying taxes, and that should move them out of the norm as far as how their cost to revenue ratios run.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we'll take that back to the staff and see if there's a way for them to fashion some sort of testing mechanism. We need all the different ideas for development of strategies that we can find in order to try to bring compliance levels up across industry sectors. And there are things that I think you're right. There are strategies that we need to look at that are industry specific and try and do better analysis of information that is available. So we will follow up on that. Thank you.
A little point, Senator. We're going to ask Legislative Revenue Office to send someone in to respond how they deal with that, so we can kind of see if we can get the two offices on the same page, or so we understand the page they're on, and we can, you know, kind of look at that issue a little more. So they should be along shortly.
Mm-hmm.
With your
very good, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday I was reporting to you, I just need to clean up something I may have misspoken. On page 39, I was describing the collection services that we provide for state government. I talked about our other agency collection program, which collects delinquent debt for state agencies. And we also have a separate function that we perform at the legislature's direction, where we are the primary collection point for court fines and assessments that are collected through the circuit and municipal courts in the state. It's a universal fee that's collected that funds certain activities at the state level, and we receive all of those dollars and then turn them over for distribution at the state level. Those are not delinquent. Delinquent charges. And as I said, if you have further questions about the responses to the questions, we'll be happy to take those up Monday, and we'll just check in with you at the end of the meeting today.
And on that, I've just been advised that Paul Warner is not in today, and he'll be in, and he's done some work on this, and he'll be in on Monday too to deal with the question.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm turning now to page 63 in the presentation materials. I have mentioned to you in January and again earlier this week that the department uses a rolling four-year business plan to plan our activities that are that add to or the efficiency and effectiveness of our operations. And we've given you some examples on page 63 and 64 of the initiatives in that plan that we think are very, very important to moving us forward on our agency vision, whether it's investing in the staff that we have so that they're best able to do the work we have given them to do, or it is making sure that our tax administration efforts are focused where they need to be focused, and that our operations are using technology to the maximum extent possible. We've talked about a number of these in the course of the presentation on the different program areas. And I would like to ask Don O'Meara to come up and join me as we go over the policy option packages that are in the governor's recommended budget, which starts on page 65.
Committee members, who's the chair at the moment? For the record, Chair. For the record, I am Don O'Meara with the Department of Revenue. I'm going to begin on page 65.
Mr. O'Meara, can you move the microphone closer? Thank you.
I'm beginning on page 65. This is policy option package 131, which deals with support for electronic filing program. For those of you that were able to tour our processing center this week, we talked some about the importance of electronic filing there. It's become an important tool for both taxpayers and for tax administrators. Last year, we received just over half of our personal income tax returns were filed electronically, some 860,000. And so this has become what we consider now a really critical application. Our history has been that we have outsourced the programming and assist the application development and maintenance of this application to the programming staff at Department of Administrative Services. and they are going out of that business. And they notified us early in this biennium that this would be the last biennium that they could provide the support, so we need to have an alternative. So what we're asking for here is not additional money, but we're asking to convert services and supplies that we have been spending on a contract basis with DAS to convert it to personal services, and so that we can fund two positions to do that work now internally. So we have two issues. One is we have to make sure that we can continue to do the work, and we have felt somewhat at risk in the last few years by not having that that knowledge in-house. It's the fact that it's been external has been a concern for us. And by doing this work in-house now, we'll be able to do some cross-training so that turnover won't threaten our ability to continue to perform here.
I just wanted to say, I highlighted this. It said, knowledge of the electronic filing system is held primarily by two individuals within DAS. Do they not let those people drive in one car together?
I don't know what the rules were there. What has really been really beneficial, just from a day-to-day operational sense, is that those two people happen to have worked inside the revenue building. So we've had, you know, pretty good contact with them, and it hasn't been that we've been in contact only by email or sale mail. That is a concern, and so if we get it in-house, we can do cross-training, and then if we have turnover or something more unfortunate, we'll still have the system knowledge.
Pass the budget.
And this particular package is directly related to our ability to process personal income tax refunds timely, which is one of our key performance measures. On page 69, Package 132 is related to our payment processing. There are two projects in this package. The first would fund the replacement of aging equipment that we have in our banking room at the Department of Revenue. This equipment prepares the tax payments for deposit and also records the information so we can properly account and apply the monies to the right taxpayer for the right tax year, for the right quarter, et cetera. So our desire is that the equipment that's in there we purchased 11 years ago. It exceeds industry standards for that type of equipment. We've been notified by the vendor that they're about to continue providing technical support for maintenance. And even recent last year or two for maintenance calls, a lot of times to replace parts, they've had to scavenge parts off of other equipment that's not in use now. And so we have been somewhat at risk here, we think, and it's really time to manage that risk and replace that equipment. Our preference is to lease rather than buy. The technology in this area is changing pretty rapidly, and we think we'll be in a better place if we're leasing rather than buying equipment, and we'll be able to be more flexible downstream as so that we can continue to take advantage of technology changes.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes, sir.
You have two of these units, is that correct?
Yes, we do.
So are we going to keep, we're going to replace them both at once, or are we going to replace one and keep the antique as spare parts for the other one, or
we're going to. I'm sorry.
What are we?
Chair,
planning?
We're going to replace them both.
Okay.
We will lease two new tracks. From an operational standpoint, we won't do them on the same. We'll spread it out to make sure that the new one's working before we replace the second, so that we don't have any downtime. But the workload requires that we have the two tracks.
That you have which?
The workload requires that we have the two machines, the two processing tracks.
Yeah, I meant do both machines have to be the same? I mean, could you not use one machine, use the new machine and an old machine?
I think that there are some problems in using the two machines that are different technology levels. I'd have to check into that. We could get back to you with that.
I understand the need for, you know, the new equipment when this equipment is getting old and frail, but sometimes in my world, that's the way that that we do things or did things with when we had duplicate equipment like that. We'd keep an old unit as spare parts for one unit and then go to, you know, the new unit on the other, knowing we'd have to. But if you could just give this some thought and get
we'll
back to
us. We'll give it some thought back to you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure I heard this right, that the company that's maintaining your equipment has notified you that they won't be doing that anymore?
The engineering department.
Oh.
For the vendor. This is old technology. They don't make it anymore. And they haven't for about 4 years. And so this often happens with technology, that after a certain period of time they quit supporting it and put all the resources to the newer level of technology.
Quick follow-up?
Follow-up.
Do you have the knowledge in-house if you were to keep one of the old ones to get running?
Chair, Representative Byer, I don't think we do to actually open up the machines and part them out and so forth. I doubt that we have that expertise.
Okay.
That would, of course, be an important variable, what you do.
Mr. Chair, we'll look at the option of replacing just the one.
Sure. Thank you.
The second project in this policy option package is to automate the processing of payments received in our field offices. Currently, it's a very manual, paper-based process. The payments that we receive in the field, we ship around the state in armored cars, process them all in our central office once they get there. It takes, on average, 3 to 4 days now to actually process and bank a payment that we receive in our field offices. This proposal in number two on this policy option package, this proposal would allow one-day banking for those payments. And it is we're using a technology model that was implemented by the State of Idaho Tax Commission that's been working quite well for them in processing of their the payments that they receive in their field offices. Internally, we track, in terms of performance measures, internally we track the how long it takes us to bank. We're trying to get as close as we can to 100% of one-day banking on all payments. Package 133 is electronic document management system. If you happen to tour our processing center this week, you saw that in spite of the success of electronic filing, and in spite of the success of electronic payments, we still receive a lot of paper. We estimate that even when we get the maximum participation in electronic filing, we think that'll be around 70%, and that we'll still be receiving 30% of those individual tax returns in paper. And that'll be, you know, when we reach that point, that'll probably, just in personal income tax returns, will be probably 600,000 to 700,000 personal tax returns each year, plus all of the correspondence. So our vision is that over the next 6 years, we will be in a basically paperless work environment to the full extent that we can. It's a strategic initiative for the department. And this policy option package is the first of three phases that will allow us to convert paper documents to digital images and electronic data at the very front of our processing pipeline, so that once we scan the documents and we verify that we have a good digital image, we will no longer have to handle those paper documents. And we will, the next time we handle them will be to turn them over to Garden to shred them. So this will be, we think, a big step in improving the productivity or the reducing the cost of processing tax returns and other documents, and it will improve our employee productivity to have immediate access to digital images, and that it will really improve the service that we can provide to taxpayers who call us anywhere in the department for assistance. The ability of the employee to instantly look at the image of the document that the taxpayer wants to talk about will enable us to give one-call service to a lot of folks that we can't do that for now.
I was just curious how the analysis, how you come to the 30% figure as kind of the max, where the maximum amount, or 70% being the maximum amount.
Well, just from looking at a lot of studies that have been done in terms of the saturation of internet access, there was actually a report done in the last week that sort of confirms that ballpark. And beyond that, a lot of people that have internet access are not comfortable conducting financial transactions over the internet, and so that is our best estimate of where that's going to be. It could be a little higher, a little low. Of course, we don't know, but that's what we are expecting.
So follow up. So reports from the multi-state tax commission or from your Department of Revenue, or you said studies.
Oh, Representative Galizio, it's been mainly looking at, looking at generally in the general population what the internet access levels are and projections by technology companies where that is going. But we also do, we work closely with the Internal Revenue Service and other states on electronic filing, and that's the general sense of where it's going to go. So it's an estimate.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm looking at this, and I'm trying to figure out the savings. I understand that it's improved service to taxpayers, but by investing in this, is there any savings that you think we'll capture from this, fiscal financial savings, or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Meyer, yes, there are. In the first biennium, they'll be pretty small because we're going to start slow and learn how to best use this technology for our purposes. And we're going to, in the first biennium, use it for the corporation tax program, which is relatively small, only about 100,000 returns a year as opposed to 1.7 or 8 million for personal income tax. We didn't want to be cutting our teeth on the bigger program. So the savings will be very small in the first biennium. But by the time we get to personal income tax in the second biennium, we think that our processing savings, we're very sure, in fact, our processing savings will be at least $500,000 a year.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you're looking at adding four positions, or I'm not sure if that's moving four positions or adding four positions, do you anticipate those savings to include not having as many employees in another department down the road, or do you anticipate any reduction of employees, I guess, in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Meyer, we think that when we get to full implementation, the work is going to change. The work is certainly going to change. And some of the positions, the work that we have them doing now in terms of processing the paper and manual keying of data, a lot of that work is going to go away. There's going to be new work, though, but we have accounted for that in our estimates. But there is new work at the front end of getting documents ready to be scanned. You can't just do that in a haphazard way. So there is, but there will. We think in the processing area there will be a net decrease in positions, and that really is where the savings, the $500,000 savings, come from. Our intent is, as we move forward in terms of good change management in our organization, is to be working with employees to make sure they know what the changes are going to be and get them prepared for new positions, with the hope that we can locate as many, you know, of them in new jobs with the department.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that's pretty much it. This this really relates to all of our productivity measures that we, which are mostly internal, in terms of how efficiently we process documents. It's, we think this is a real key step for us. I wanted to reiterate this: what we're doing this biennium, this next biennium, would be the first of three phases till we fully use this technology for all of our tax programs.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the next policy option package, number 151, which is described on page 79 in the materials, is one that Susan talked about in her presentation on the income tax programs, verifying eligibility for refundable credits. The governor's recommended budget included 12 positions and related costs for us to continue to work on verifying claims for refundable credits. We have had one, the working family credit, which has been refundable for the past three tax years, and the fourth one that we're processing right now. And then we've got two more that we talked about, the earned income credit and the mobile home park closure related credit. What we would do with the positions, we've actually moved people within the organization into evaluating, reviewing the working family credit applications as they've come in over the last, these three processing seasons. And the data on the numbers of claims and how many we've adjusted and the amount of refunds that were improperly claimed are in the material. What we would do with those positions would be to continue to review questionable claims, try to get those resolved more quickly. Right now we're averaging about 120 to 130 days for claims that have to go to our special unit that's reviewing the working family credit. We would continue to do that upfront screening, and but we would put quite a bit of effort into educating folks who are eligible to claim the credit, daycare providers who are crucial because they provide the receipts that are the basis for the credit, other agencies and tax preparers, about the what needs to be done so that people are eligible for and can properly claim the credits, and then devote some resource to ensuring that the daycare providers are also, and this is related, to, I think, to the question Senator Whitsitt asked, using information we've got in relation to one aspect of compliance to assure compliance in another area. We've established a goal for ourselves, if we were to get the entire package, of trying to reduce the time within which we would pay review and pay a refund from 120 down to 90 days. The one of the challenges with particularly the well, I think with all three of the credits is that they all have a condition of the person who's claiming the credit having a lower amount of income, and some folks haven't filed before, and or they really need the money. And one of the things that happens if we get hung up with one of the refundable credits is we get a lot of phone calls from the person who's asked for the credit because they have either a rent payment or an electric bill or something that they want to use that money for. And the longer it takes us to work with them to resolve what the correct credit amount is, the more anxious that they get. So that's the purpose of that. And we also are just our general, time for refunds. This goes into that total average time for refunds, which is one of our key performance measures.
Representative Lizio.
So you would estimate go from 120 to 90 days?
That would be the goal.
That would be the goal, okay. Because I think it was 110 the last time.
Well,
but my question is the... How did you arrive at 12 positions?
Well, we looked at what we're using today in terms of the volumes of returns that are coming in, and trying to balance that value of making sure that the refunds that go out are accurate, and getting them out as quickly as possible. It's taking a team of four revenue agents and eight tax auditors during the filing season in order to do the work that is coming in. And we're, you know, we learn as we go through more seasons and work more efficiently with the returns. But we've got a group that's the level of activity during the season. Even after the bulk of the filing season is concluded, we still have a smaller number of people that we keep on the ones that are taking longer. And then if there's a request for review or an appeal, they have to, you know, be available to, or an amended return, they have to be available to process those. So that's the team. And then the additional folks would be the ones that would be working out in community with tax preparers, child care providers, and other state agencies that work with folks who would be eligible, in order to get more information out there about what's the correct way to claim, how the validating information needs to be provided, and so forth. So it's the outreach portion would be additional effort that we can't make right now.
Just clarification. So you said four revenue, and I forgot the name,
revenue agents.
Agents, yeah. And then eight tax auditors. In other words, that's what the POP calls for, or that's what exists in the status quo?
Well, we are moving that number of people during the processing season, which is about 6 months, from their current work. So what the policy option package would enable us to do is replace that capacity in our core work, our base work, and devote resource instead of diverting resource.
Thank you.
Okay, Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was kind of surprised that it wasn't more of a reduction in time, but I'm assuming there is a definite time that's going to take no matter what. I mean, there's just so much involved in this that you just can't narrow it down. But what would you guess that amount of time would be? If you had unlimited resources to do this, how long do you think it would take?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, if I had unlimited resources, I would need three new buildings. And you know, what we try to do is balance all of the needs of the program and provide an appropriate amount of resource within that context. If we had this policy option package, what we would be able to do that we aren't able to do now is a little more front-end preventive work, so that more of the returns would come in, or claims would come in correctly in the first place. There will always be folks who are new to the program, first time they're applying for the credit. There's a lot of information they have to provide in order to be eligible. There are a lot of criteria. So there's a fairly high level of misunderstanding, and that will be there. But if we're able to, and I ask the staff to compartmentalize this just a little bit, for folks that get it all right and everything's there and it goes right through, we're able to process those in just about the same amount of time we can process any other return. For some where the concerns or the errors are fairly minor and they can be resolved with short contact with the taxpayer or just a manual review of the return, those we can get out in 30 to 45 days. The ones that take a really long time and that make that average really big are ones where we've got to go back and actually verify who the provider was, whether there was actually a payment in cash for the service, whether the claimant is in the right income envelope, and it involves a lot of interaction with the claimant, and that drags out when it takes them a long time to get their information together or a long time to respond to us. So it's not every claim that would take 120 days or even 90 days. That's the average, and it's really the ones that are the sticky ones that this group deals with. They don't look at all of them. They look at about half, maybe a little under half at this point. And so what we're going to try and do is apply that resource. We get the number of difficult ones down as small as we can, put an appropriate amount of resource there so that it's not taking way too long to process, and get more of them into the just normal and short window.
Thank you.
Any other questions on that one? Okay. I'd like to ask Jack Ogami to come back up to the table with me on the next two policy option packages because they're related to tobacco. We also have some representatives from the our two partner agencies, the Oregon State Police and the Department of Justice, here to talk about tobacco issues. So I think I'll leave the table.
Okay.
And give this over to Jack, and then I think we're going to have some folks from the counties here about 9:45 to testify during the public hearing, and we wanted to make sure that we left time for that. So thank you very much, and here's Jack.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Good morning, Jack.
For the record, my name is Jack Ogami. I'm the Business Division Administrator at the Department of Revenue.
Jack, turn the mic up towards you a little bit. Yeah, okay. That's fine.
This morning, I'd like to set the stage for the discussion of our two policy option packages, which are in your book on pages 83 and 85. They're noted as policy option packages 152 and 161. And together, these policy option packages propose renewing the funding for the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, including our compliance work on individuals who purchase cigarettes over the Internet. Now, we've invited the task force partners to join us after I do the setup. My understanding is the committee would like us to identify how we add value to the tobacco tax programs and to quantify the outcomes of our recent activities. And to do that, we've sent, did you all pick up a little handout with a chart on the front? That's titled Tobacco Compliance Task Force Activities and Outcomes. The first section on this chart identifies the activities to bank money, process returns, and provide customer service to the 270 distributors. They're going to be helping us generate the $528 million next biennium. And the projected cost of these core services is approximately $1 million. Section 2 of our report focuses on the compliance and enforcement activities. The task force partners have agreed that our performance measure for these activities will be the amount of tax avoidance we identify and stop. In the most recent 24-month period, our task force members have conducted 130 audits. We've sent 39,000 bills to Oregonians who have purchased cigarettes over the Internet. We've conducted 56 criminal investigations, which has led to 21 criminal prosecutions. And as a result of these activities, we've identified and stopped almost $7 million in tax avoidance. So that's the high-level overview of our activities and the direct value we've attributed to the task force over the last 24 months. And at this point, I'd like to ask my task force partners to come forward, and we could answer any questions you might have related to the information on this sheet. My task force partner members are Donna Maddox from the Department of Justice and Lieutenant Michael Gingham from the Oregon State Police. I'll let them introduce themselves and what they do.
Again, for the record, Chair, members of the committee, my name is Donna Maddox. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I've been one of the two prosecutors assigned to the task force for the last 3 years. One of my primary areas of responsibility has been the Internet and delivery sales enforcement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dingeman. I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police. I oversee our drug enforcement section. One of the programs that's underneath my section is the tobacco, the OSP portion of the Tobacco Compliance Task Force.
Okay. Do you have any questions about the first chart, or are you ready to go to page two?
Senator Whitson.
Chair Jensen. Jack, it would appear that your voluntary compliance is losing money significantly, and your compliance and enforcement is making about a dollar and a half for every dollar invested. Is that correct?
On the voluntary compliance side,
The functions that we provide are primarily the functions to get the $528 million into the bank. So I don't know if you can say it's losing money. It's
costing almost a million to get it. Those are in millions?
Yeah, it's costing $994,007.09.
To collect $529.
Yes. Yes, sir.
20 million.
What?
How much of that would you collect without spending the $994,000?
Well, we wouldn't have the staff to manage the cigarette tax stamps. We wouldn't have the staff to license distributors, and we wouldn't have the funding to open the envelopes and bank the checks and answer the calls that distributors make. This is all the infrastructure that goes behind the program in terms of preparing the forms, getting the returns into the door, banking the payments that come with those returns. So there's a lot of behind the scenes activities that go to support each payment that comes in with an OTP return or each purchase of cigarette tax stamps.
Follow up, Senator?
Yeah, I'm a little
okay.
A little slow here, I think, but what you're saying is that the $994,000 you're spending is actually buying something other than the collection of the $569,000.
It's paying for the infrastructure that the tax program sits upon. So the dollars that come in, the tax returns that go out, the cigarette tax stamps, the individuals that we pay to process the paperwork and make the bank deposits. We share in the overhead costs from the Department of Revenue's systems that do a lot of those functions. We have our allocated share of those costs included in this $994,000.
So then in addition to the collection of $569,000, they run the whole program?
$1 million.
$569 million. $528 million.
That's where I'm confused. I'm looking at $994,669 million. I dropped a decimal point there. So obviously my line of questioning was erroneous because I was comparing thousands to millions.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Wish my bank would do that.
Depends on.
Well, no.
In the positive.
Think of the problem you'd have with the other folks here if your bank did that.
Well, that's all right. We don't fund them enough, so they wouldn't.
Okay. I understand that where this $994,000 comes from is the fact that the legislature or the citizens, as the case may have been, enacted a statute that required a tobacco tax. That tobacco tax currently then generates $500 and some million, but the basic operation cost for, if you're saying not voluntary compliance, but just the nuts and bolts of the operation is basically $1 million.
$1 million, yes, sir.
And I suppose, probably the thing at least I would be most interested in is not so much, I mean, this is important, and I would want to not emphasize that, but the area of noncompliance, I guess, and the value of the economic or the dollar value of what we're getting out of trying to deal with the less than straightforward folks out there who are finding cheaper ways or trying to find cheaper ways to subsidize their habit, more than the compliance area. at least for me, that would be one of the areas that I would like to hear you talking about. You know, what are we tying up state police and prosecutors for, and how much bang for the buck are we getting from you know, this? What's this costing us, and how much are we getting from that?
Okay.
Is that understood? Okay.
Yes, sir. That's section two of this report, which right. is the compliance and enforcement activities, where the projected 07-09 cost is about $4.4 million. And if you look back at the similar level of activities over the last 24 months, we've generated direct results of $6.9 million. And audits of OTP, which generated almost $2.9 million. This is when the task force receives tips, or we go out and we visit distributors, and our senior tax auditor examines the records and identifies the amount of non-compliance, and we issue a billing, and we collect that.
So help me a little bit, if you can here, Jack. Basically, we're making $2.5 million for an expenditure of $4.4 million.
The 4.4 is for the entire task force, the DOJ, the OSP, the Department of Justice, the Department of Revenue, and the Oregon State Police together comprise the task force, and that cost for 07-09 is projected to be approximately $4.4 million.
And that task force has generated $6.9 million.
Correct.
So we're basically making about $2.5 million for an investment of $4.5 million
in direct tax avoidance stopped.
Yeah, is that?
If I might, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Donna Maddox. I'm the prosecutor on the task force. The numbers that you are seeing on page one are direct dollars identified through either an audit by the Department of Revenue or a criminal judgment that we obtained in a case. So if you compare that to the cost, yes, you're seeing about a $2.5 million increase there, or at least a return. Part of the story of the effect of what we do with prosecutions and investigations is the increase in voluntary compliance that goes on and the increase in revenues collected. And I think that you also have two different charts that show you what's called OTP receipts over the 12-month moving total and the cigarette receipts over the 12-month moving total. When it comes to our prosecutions and our investigations, we have expended a lot of energy and spent a lot of time working the OTP or other tobacco products cases. There is the greatest amount of opportunity for tax evasion, cheating, and other related criminal activity in that area because, unlike cigarettes, tobacco products don't bear the tax stamp, and the system is a voluntary honor system reporting. And so what we're seeing is not just as a result of the prosecutions and investigations, the collections as a result of audits and prosecutions, but I believe we've seen a significant increase in OTP receipts in the time period in which the task force has been present in the community. And folks we talked to comment on the fact that it's much more risky to cheat now than it used to be.
Well, so you're saying it has a deterrent effect too, and that's you can't really quantify that.
We can't. The only number that we have is what are people actually paying in the time period that the task force has been on the ground.
I understand that, but I think maybe that. You know, at least estimates can be quantified on that, as to what the deterrent effect might be. And, I'm not making the statement here now that we shouldn't spend $4.4 million to save $6.9 million. Okay, I mean, I'm trying to get an idea of what sort of, return we really do have on our dollar. And I do appreciate, representatives pointed out here that there is a deterrent effect, that lacking an enforcement there might not, you know, there might be a much larger non-compliance than there is with an enforcement sort of thing. So, and I don't know, we sometimes play a delicate game trying to get a happy medium on that, so that, you know, that's all I'm trying to arrive at here is that issue. So go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in discussions with the task force and trying to calculate some type of a... Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in discussions with our task force partners and trying to determine what would be a good measure of the deterrent impact of our enforcement activities, one of the things that we all agreed upon was that for the tax avoidance that we've identified and we've stopped, we believe that a good measure, a good approximate measure, would be one biennium's impact of that tax going forward. That we believe that we've restored, a good measure would be that's the amount of tax that we've restored back to the system. So the $6.9 million we've identified here is looking backwards. And now looking forwards, I believe that we roughly estimate that the deterrent impact of those activities will be 6.2. I believe 6.2 to $6.5 million per biennium, or in the next 24-month period.
Okay. All right.
Okay. The next.
We had any incarcerations out of your prosecutions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have had incarcerations. We have had individuals who have been sentenced to as much in county time as 13 months. We have an individual right now who is awaiting entry of plea and sentencing who has agreed to serve 16 months. We have asked for and people were eligible for as much as 32 to 36 months under the sentencing guidelines. It has been difficult to get judges to impose those because of the nature of these crimes.
Any smoking judges? Senator Whitson.
Chair Jensen, thank you. Actually, three questions. The total tax avoidance, was that money actually collected or was that money identified? I mean, did the people actually pay it?
In some instances, they did. I believe in other instances, they didn't. They were put out of business.
Okay. Second question on the Oregon State Police's involvement here. How many FTE are involved, and what is your biennial charge to the Department of Justice? Department of Revenue, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, we have four FTE that are detectives and then one that's a supervising sergeant. One of the four detectives is the one that we use for our a lot of the computer forensics that is necessary when we execute search warrants and seize records. And I believe our biennial cost is right around $1.2 million, give or take.
Okay. And then from the Department of Justice side, what is the cost of the Department of Revenue for the Department of Justice's charges?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I don't have that number available to me right now.
Could you make that the department probably has or should have it?
We may have it in our records.
We don't have to hold up right now for that, but could you make that available to us for the Monday meeting, please?
Turning to page two of the packet, this is a graph that depicts the cigarette dollars that were lost through internet sales as reported to us from a national marketing statistic gathering firm. And in September of 2003, based on the information we received from this company, it looked like we were losing approximately $5 million a year in cigarette taxes to internet sales of cigarettes. In 2004, we were losing almost $7 million. And then there were some significant events that took place that were led by the Department of Justice that by September 2005, this company was reporting the losses were down below $2 million. So I'd like to ask Donna Maddox to explain some of those actions that were taken and the impact that helps explain the impact of the reduction in internet sales.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when I was assigned to the task force in 2004, I was informed that one of the things that I would be working was the internet, and that the legislature had directed us to go and fix the problem that we had with internet cigarettes. That issue had not been addressed by any state or federal agencies at that time in a comprehensive manner. We started to work with other states, with ATF, with Customs, to try and find ways to creatively enforce what is a very difficult issue to address, because obviously internet sellers are placed all over the country, all over the world, and use a variety of very difficult to identify payment and shipping systems. But through the work that we were able to lead with the state of California and the state of New York, we were able to get all of the credit card companies, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express, and PayPal, to agree in March of 2005 to stop the processing of all illegal sales of cigarettes, which for many of those credit card companies meant they immediately shut off those merchant accounts for all the sites they could identify. That for us was probably the largest win and resulted in a very dramatic drop in internet cigarette activity, because if you can't use your credit card to buy cigarettes online, what we found is that people are much less likely to go that route. We also worked with the carriers, UPS, DHL, and FedEx, to try and stop the shipment of those illegal cigarettes. We are at a point right now where the only way you can legally receive cigarettes at your doorstep is through the United States Postal Service. We are working with the National Associations of Attorneys General to push federal legislation which would stop that. We've also worked with our federal entities to try and get them to start figuring out ways to make it harder for overseas companies to ship cigarettes into the United States. You'll see on the chart in December of 2004, ATF and ICE agents that we work with here in Oregon, accompanying New York agents, in identifying full planes that were coming in filled with cigarettes from YesSmokes.com, which at the time was the largest internet cigarette seller in the world. And because we couldn't stop them when we got to people's doorsteps, they decided if they could stop the plane that was full of cigarettes, it was the only thing that it was carrying, we'd be able to effectively manage that situation. The outcome of the seizure of, it was 2 weeks, they seized every plane that came in. There were approximately 2 to 3 planes per week. What ended up happening was, as a result of the Visa and MasterCard chargebacks to that site, that largest site ended up stopping its shipments into the United States. So we've had a very non-traditional approach to dealing with this problem. We are still doing enforcement. As you may imagine, the internet is a great venue for sales, and people who want to continue to sell will figure out ways to do it. We are now working to try and limit the internet sellers who are still out there and present from using EFT payments, which is what they're doing now. You can send a check or you can send your debit card in order to pay. We're trying to cut down on the continued shipment using the United States Postal System. As you can imagine also, we have to work with the credit card companies to do the stings and make sure that companies aren't just turning over and misrepresenting who they are as a merchant on the internet, continuing to do those sales. As people respond to our enforcement activities, mail order has become a larger problem, and it's much more difficult to identify because they don't have a web presence. But we are moving in that direction. We continue to work on joint enforcement efforts. We've been very pleased with the way that our current enforcement efforts have turned out. We've had a great deal of support from the Attorney General and the heads of our departments, and I think that has made a huge difference in the ongoing enforcement. The problem is still out there. We are not getting the types of Jenkins reports that we should be getting under both federal law and the state delivery sales laws, and we are currently working with about 10 other states to attempt to civilly sue a tribal member who owns and operates 8 sites right now that represent probably collectively the largest number of non-conforming sites. So they're out there. They're selling cigarettes into our state. They refuse to comply with our laws.
All these plane loads coming in, can you confiscate the airplane?
They didn't confiscate the airplane. They confiscated the contents.
I'm asking the question. can or could you?
Well, it would be it was a federal seizure, so I'm not sure what ATF's plan was.
I mean, I'm thinking if they're bringing cigarettes in, it's probably not a Cessna 172.
Yeah. They were coming in DHL carriers. So what you have is a problem working with the carrier, making sure that the carrier is aware of what they were bringing in. This obviously helped us a great extent in getting DHL to agree to stop doing what they were doing. Because otherwise, law-abiding companies like the carriers and the credit card companies want to be seen as not engaging in international criminal activities.
Other questions? Got some information coming here, I gather.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, to your earlier question about the DOJ cost, looks like for six FTE, the total cost was $1.6 million.
Thank you.
Help me, this 1.2 and 1.6 is part of the task force. 4 point or whatever it was. Thank you. Thank you.
The last three slides we'd like to review with you are the graphical presentations of the cigarette tax receipts, the other tobacco products tax receipts, and the cumulative effect of our enforcement actions since the task force was started. And the first graph is the cigarette tax receipts 12-month moving average totals. And the three spikes you see in 1995, 1998, and 2002 represent increases in the tax rate, where the tax went up in 1995 from 28 to 38 cents per pack. In 1998, we had a significant increase from 38 to 68 cents per pack. And then in 2002 and 2003, we had an increase from 68 cents a pack to $1.28. And then the rate went back down to $1.18 in 2003. So those account for the three major spikes between 1994 and 2006. The interesting story that this graph tells is that between 1998 and 2002, the definite trend of the graph in terms of receipts, the tax rate was the same. The revenues were declining, and that was consistent with the national story that people were choosing to stop smoking nationwide. Then in 2002-2003, we had the rate increase. But if you look at the direction of the line from 2004 to 2006, we created the Tobacco Compliance Task Force in year 2001, I believe. And you can see the trend of the line, even though it's slight, the trend is upwards. So we believe that the Tobacco Compliance Task Force did have some effect on tobacco tax revenues. The next chart... The Tobacco Compliance Task Force over the last biennium and a half has spent significant amount of time and effort in enforcement of the other tobacco tax laws. And other tobacco taxes, you'll see the significant bump in 1998. And our economists explained to me that bump is actually the crossover effect, where there was a significant increase in the cigarette tax, so people crossed over and started using other tobacco products instead of purchasing cigarettes. Now, the consumption line, which was probably being represented by the tax receipts line between 1998 and 2002-2003, is relatively flat. And then it increases from 2003 to 2006, 50%, from approximately $20 million per year to $30 million per year. We believe that the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, while not taking credit for all of that increase, had a significant impact on the overall increase in those revenue streams. And the last chart, the solid line depicts the cumulative effect of the tax avoidance that we've identified and stopped through the tobacco tax compliance. And it's the upward trend in the direction of the activity is directly corresponds with the change in the other tobacco products' overall revenue.
Has the Revenue Department or the Justice Department ever looked at your complicity in the criminal activity that would take place by having Washington residents coming over to Oregon, buying cigarettes out of your stores with Oregon stamps on them, taking them back to Washington? I mean, you're the supply. The state here is a supplier of cigarettes to Washington residents that would otherwise have to pay Washington tax on them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I had the opportunity to attend the Senate Revenue Committee hearing, and I heard this legislative revenue officer talking about how they factor in the cross-border sales in their estimation of the cigarette revenues to be received, but I don't believe the Department of Revenue has done any specific activities related to that. I can ask my partners.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if your question is specific to criminal investigations and enforcement, we work very closely with the Washington Liquor Control Board, who does the investigations related to tobacco tax evasion. We have not had an instance where they've come to us seeking assistance in cross-border activity that they believe would lead to criminal activity in their state. As you may know from earlier testimony, we are typically looking at large-scale purchases for resale, and they have not come to us with information related to that.
I certainly appreciate that the focus of your activity is going to be on large scale, because we're talking about kind of small ticket items and therefore need for large scale to make million plus dollar expenditures pencil out. But I just find it somewhat ironic that we're spending a whole bunch of money to beat up on a whole bunch of people that are going someplace else to buy cigarettes or tobacco products and bringing them into the state, but we're also exporting them out of the state, admittedly in very smaller quantities, to our neighboring state to the north. Now, I happen to be fairly familiar with this particular issue because I live in a border county, and I know of a couple of stores that are located immediately on the other side of the Washington, Oregon, on this side of the Washington, Oregon border. And the proprietors of those stores are somewhat concerned about what the consequences of their business in Washington, or in Oregon, will be if we raise our tax to be equal to that of the state of Washington. So, just a little irony, I guess, here, that sort of thing. But as long as it's the government doing it, I guess it must be okay, right? Are there other observations or questions of the task force? Thank you, Jack.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Uh-huh. And Elizabeth, she didn't disappear. Do you have other items before we move on to public testimony?
Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation of our budget materials. We'll be prepared to answer any additional questions you have as you go into work session. But I think now's the time. We know we have a couple of guests who have some public testimony.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And when are we scheduled here for work session?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are scheduled for public hearing and possible work session for Monday. We expect to be able to begin the work session on Monday, but we understand there will be some additional public testimony. We also left Monday open for answering any questions that were left open from today.
Sure. Okay. Okay. At this point, I guess we've been in the. We will open the public testimony on House Bill 5041. We have two people signed up, Scott Langton and Ray Erland. Is it Erland? Thank you.
ready?
I'm ready.
Good morning. I'm Scott Langton. I'm the Deschutes County Assessor and current president of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify and provide information as far as the Department of Revenue's budget, particularly the property tax side of things. So as you folks probably well know, that Oregon has an extremely complex property tax system. There's been many challenges given to us, especially with the passages of Measure 5 and Measure 50. And it's increased our challenges to administer the system efficiently, fairly, and effectively. The Department of Revenue serves as both an oversight agency as well as a partner to the counties in administering the system. The Department of Revenue also offers support in many areas such as training, appraisal, assessment, taxation, and mapping. It's important, at least in my viewpoint, to have a stable, accurate statewide property tax system. It's the same set of rules for all 36 counties. That way, accurate property values help ensure the fair distribution of the tax burden to taxpayers. It ensures that the taxing districts receive the dollars that their voters approve so they can provide the services to their citizens. And the timely and accurate assessment of new property, especially under the Measure 50 environment, is very crucial. And who gets the money on this? The vast majority of property taxes go to K-12. They're the biggest one at 40%. Cities are second at 22%. Counties 19%. Then down. Now, with this partnership with the Department of Revenue, it helps us look at issues that are before us both at a local level and a statewide level. And we're currently working with the department, working closely with them on a number of fairly significant issues currently. Probably one of the biggest is the loss or the potential loss of the federal forest funds. There's some issues revolving data sharing versus record suppression legislation and some competing interests there. And then there's some potential legislation revolving around intangibles. The primary funding for assessment and taxation functions at the county is through most counties' general fund at approximately 75%, with about 25% coming from the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance Grant, or CAFA. And I might point out in that written testimony on page 2 there that these CAFA distributions, which come from delinquent interest and recording fees, have remained fairly constant, somewhat decreased over the last several years, where county expenditures for assessment and taxation have increased. And that increase is primarily due to inflation and also the increased workload due to population growth and the cost of administering the program, where several years ago this CAFA funding function was supporting approximately 36% of assessment taxation, where today it's about 25% we're projecting. So that it's getting less and less as time goes on. The current governor's recommended budget of the $5.1 million for this biennium is a crucial component of this function. But with that gap, or the percentage getting less and less, it might be appropriate to actually consider a larger amount on that.
Questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Whitson.
You know, you mentioned the record sharing and information suppression just in passing. Could you develop that a little bit more? Because that's something this committee has been dealing with for some time now.
Yeah, I'd be happy to touch on that. And actually, I appreciate your web stream that you can watch these hearings over the Internet. I did see the testimony yesterday and some of the questions that Senator Johnson had on that. we've got, at least from the assessor's position, we're the keepers of these records, and we're keeping them updated and whatnot, and it's like there's conflicting government entities. There's the data sharing, which is some very valuable secondary uses of our records that we keep. And the data sharing is looking at doing that. And then, but there's also legislation out there through other government entities that are looking at removing that and saying there's too much information out there. And there's probably half a dozen bills currently in different places this session. Police officers, district attorneys, healthcare professionals. I don't know what will come down the road in future years. So I think, and our association has asked that those be combined into a, maybe an interim work group where we can look at a more global picture there. Our association is also, as far as the data sharing and the, what DAS has put together or requested for an interim group, we've signed a resolution that we're more than happy to come to the table and have those discussions there, too. But it's how do we look at this more globally on these competing interests on what's appropriate and what isn't. So did that answer your question?
Yes, I think. Follow-up.
Follow-up.
So primarily you're concerned about the suppression of information, statutory suppression of information on public safety officers and so forth for like their names, addresses, phone numbers, contact information.
Yeah, Chair, Senator, that's what the legislation is right now, and each one of the bills is asking to suppress different pieces of information. One might be the situs address, another might be the name, and it's how do we administer that, for one, and what's appropriately a public record and what isn't. And if we limited it just to these smaller groups, well, healthcare professionals, of course, isn't. I don't know what ramification that'll have, but next session, if it's school teachers or business owners or whomever else, as this expands, I don't know, I'd like to at least see the conversation now on defining what is and what isn't the public record, and how does this all fit into this broader picture of data sharing between the various state agencies and private sector.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ray Irvin Clack, Miss County Assessor. I'll just summarize. $4 billion annually is collected statewide on property taxes, so it's a lot of revenue for over 1,400 taxing districts and the state of Oregon, including the school districts. $1.6 billion of the $4 billion is K-12, and it's important, as you know, because we do generate revenue, and as well as Department of Revenue and the property tax function, that we're adequately funded to continue to do the work we do and to provide the revenue. And there's been a lot of discussion about adequate funding, secure rural schools. On Monday, you'll hear about secure rural schools and the federal forest funding and loss of up to 69% at some of the county level and what's going to happen. So I think hopefully the federal government will fund that portion again for a few years, and if they don't, then I think we'll have a real discussion about how we can provide the revenue to all the districts. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much, Dallin. Appreciate your being here. Appreciate the information you have for us, and you've got to go back across the mountain today.
No, actually, I'm fortunate enough I get to stay over for another meeting tomorrow, too.
Oh. Darn, it's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it.
I do appreciate the weather, though. This
well,
is nice over here.
We wanted it to resemble a little bit the east side, you know. Okay, any other concluding comments? If not, we are adjourned.
Thank you.